Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sink or Swim podcast sponsored by NSUMD. I'm Daniel Acevedo and I'll be your host for the next couple episodes. For those of you that already know me, you can probably guess the topic of this podcast, but for those that don't, this podcast will be about orthopedic surgery. Today we're going to be dissecting what I like to call Ortho Basics Part 1. This will most likely be a two-part series, and we're going to try to cover everything that's high yield for your way rotations. I know there's a lot of materials out there. You can kind of get boggled down in the details in terms of what do you need to know, where should you be getting this information. I'm going to try to synthesize this all for you in one place, which is this podcast, and hopefully by the end of it, you'll know everything that's high yield and you'll be able to answer maybe not all, but if most PIMP questions that you get. This will be a Divine style podcast. If you don't listen to Divine, it means that it's just me alone in the studio and I'm going to be yapping for an hour or two. In this specific episode, we're going to cover the different types of bones, how they form, how to read x-rays, and how fractures heal. So if you're already comfortable with those topics, you should probably just skip to part two. Starting with the bones themselves, you have your flap bones, like your sternum. They provide protection and give a broad surface for muscle attachments. Next, you have your long bones, like your femur and your humerus. They're responsible for movement and support. Next, there's your short bones, which are the ones in your wrists. They're important for stability and fine motor control. Then you got your irregular bones, which are things like your vertebrae. So these have like very complex shape and they serve specific functions. Depending on whether you're in the cervical region, thoracic region, or lumbar region, the pedicle placement on them is actually different. That's probably a little too niche for this basics podcast, but if you're going to be on a spine rotation, it'll definitely behoove you to know that information. Last up, we got your sesamoid bones. That'll be your patella, or if you're not there yet, your kneecap. You also have two sesamoid bones in the big toe of your foot. So sesamoid bones are bones that are embedded either like in a tendon or a ligament. And they provide leverage and reduce friction. So that's the categories of bones. Now we got to talk about how bones form, which is called ossification. There's two types of ossification. You have intramembranous ossification, and you have endochondral ossification. So for intramembranous ossification, think of it like a direct flight. You've got these stem cells, okay? And they transform straight into bone-building cells called osteoblasts. That's how your flat bones form. There's no layover in the city of cartilage for those bones. So endochondral ossification, it's a little bit more roundabout. You have your mesenchymal stem cells. They differentiate into chondrocytes, which build a cartilage model on the bone. And then you have your cartilage model, which gradually gets replaced by bone. It's kind of like building a temporary structure out of wood and then replacing it with concrete over time. Importantly, endochondral ossification is what happens at your long bones in the growth plates when you're growing as a kid. And so it's pretty important to know what this looks like histologically. It's one of those things that you most likely won't get pimped on, but it's not in the realm of possibility. At the bare minimum, you should probably know the different zones of the growth plate and what's going on at each of these zones. If you can recognize those zones on a histological slide, all the better. I mean, this is one of the few histological slides that you'll have to know. Unless you're doing an oncology rotation, that's pretty much it for histology. Now, one thing that's true about all bones, when you're looking at them with the naked eye, is that they have two parts, right? There's the cortical bone and there's the cancellous bone. Your cortical bone, which can also be known as your compact bone, it's very dense, it's very strong. Sometimes when you're in the operating room and you're trying to drill through it, the drills start to give off smoke because of how hot it gets. And one of the things you can do as a med student on your way rotations is to ask for a bulb syringe water. You can spray some of that water onto the drill to help cool it down to keep the bone from overheating and necrose. I would say that in terms of when you're on an orthopedic wear rotation, that's one of the higher level moves that you can do in the OR to maybe stand out. The issue with doing it is that you have to know when it matters that if the bone is going to necrose or not. If you're drilling through something that you're going to like just rip out in a couple of minutes, it doesn't matter, right? If you're trying to fix a fracture, then you're going to want to avoid some bone necrosis. So this isn't something that you're going to want to do every time you see the drill come out. Maybe wait until you kind of start having a little bit more of a feel in the OR, have some idea of what's going on, and then if you feel like comfortable, especially you're working with a team that has a nice scrub tech, you can start trying to do that. If you see that the scrub tech is doing it, then you can definitely ask them to let you do it. And if you're really lucky, some scrub techs will just hand you the bulb syringe, and then you don't even have to, you know, put two and two together. But so going back into the types of bone, you got your cortical bone, you got your spongy bone. Talked about cortical bone already. So spongy bone, it's like a honeycomb structure, and it's found on the inside of bones, obviously. It provides support, it's also lighter, it's kind of like an internal scaffolding, it helps distribute weight and forces. It's like there's always a balance between strength and lightness. That's like a common theme throughout the skeletal system. When we zoom down further onto the microscopic level, you also see this duality when it comes to woven bone and laminar bone. So woven bone is formed very quickly, but it's not as organized or as strong as laminar bone. It's kind of like a rough draft of bone tissue. When you get a fracture, this is the type of bone that's going to be initially put down to kind of hold the two pieces of your now broken bone. Then you get your laminar bone by having the woven bone be remodeled. The main difference comes down to, at a more molecular level, the laminar bone, it's much more organized, and so that is where the strength comes from. So you can think of woven bone as like the quick fix and laminar bone as more of the long-term solution. So now that we have all those basic concepts in terms of bone biology down, let's start talking about how we look at bones. X-rays, our go-to first diagnostic tool. Now, like with all diagnostic imaging, you gotta be able to know what you're looking at. And if you go online, especially if you decide to go on Reddit, like our medical school, there's a lot of different mnemonics that you will find to read x-rays. And so it's really just about picking which one works best for you in terms of you being able to memorize it. My favorite one to start off with is the ABCs. So that's your alignment, bones, cartilage, and soft tissues. So one of the first things you want to look at is the alignment. Check the overall alignment of the bones relative to the joints and relative to each other. Next up is B. So B stands for bones. You want to look at the bone density and the cortical thickness. It'll probably take a couple rounds of repetition before you start to gain an appreciation for this, and that's fine. The other thing is to go through the cortex of the bone, see if there's any clear fractures or abnormalities within the bone structure. C is cartilage, so you're gonna want to assess joint spaces. You want to look for any narrowing or widening, especially if you're looking at an X-ray of the knee. This will be very relevant if you're in joints clinic. Any narrowing or widening could indicate some sort of cartilage damage. And then the last S is for soft tissues. So you want to examine the surrounding soft tissues for any swelling, masses, or abnormalities. You want to see if the bone, if you're looking at a fracture, if the bone is sticking out of the soft tissues, because that could clue you in that this might be an open fracture. Obviously, we don't really get X-rays to look at soft tissues, so your visibility is somewhat limited, but it's something you want to look out for either way. Some other things you want to consider when, or now that we're talking about X-rays, that you should consider when you're on your away rotations is the rule of two. And so when you're at your trauma board rounds, if it's just you and the residents, if they're nice, they might, try to take some time to pimp you slash teach you. And one of their favorite lines is typically, is to kind of look at you and go, "One view is," and you're supposed to reply with, "No views." And so, what does that mean? And it means that because we're looking at a 3D structure in space, you can't get an accurate representation of what's going on based off of only one view, one X-ray view. And so, typically, you want to get at least two views. And those would be your AP and lateral. Sometimes you can get a third view, which will be your oblique or your mortise view. Mortise is more for your ankle. And then if you're talking about like a arm or a wrist, then it would be an oblique view. Another thing is that you always want to compare both sides. If you get an AP of the pelvis, then you're fortunate and then you're automatically going to get both sides, and it doesn't take any conscious effort on your part. But if you're looking at a tibia or a femur, and something seems a little bit off in terms of curvature, you don't know if maybe, you don't know what that patient's normal is. You want to get an imaging on the other side, and that'll help you establish, okay, what is normal for this patient. Other things you're going to want to consider are the exact location of the fracture, if there is one. So, what part of the bone? Is it in the diaphysis? Is it in the metaphysis? Is it in the epiphysis? You want to determine if there's any articular extension of the fracture. You want to determine the pattern of the fracture, whether it's comminuted, transverse, oblique, spiral. Sometimes when you're learning this material for the first time, the shorter acronyms can be a little bit harder to use because they put more pressure on you as the student to remember everything that you need to be covering in one letter versus some of the longer acronyms. If you can remember what the letters stand for, there's less pressure on you to kind of remember everything that goes into that one particular letter. So the ABCS acronym, it might not be ideal if this is your first time getting practice reading X-rays. Another acronym that's also popular is WALTER. And so WALTER stands for what is it, age, location, type, extension, and related injuries. And so this one already has some of the things I just mentioned already incorporated in the acronym, and so it's less pressure on you to kind of remember those extra tidbits. So the what is it means, what X-ray views do you have?
The age means, obviously, again, is this like a skeletally immature patient or a skeletally mature patient? You're gonna want to look at the growth plates to determine that. The L stands for location. And so by location, it means what part of the bone are you in? Not just what bone is it. And so is it, proximal metaphysis, diaphysis, distal metaphysis? And then notably in this one, the T stands for type. And so you can get a little bit fancier with this in terms of what type of fracture do you have? Not only talking about whether it's a spiral, oblique, transverse, but also incorporating E for extension and assessing whether or not it extends into the joint line, like we mentioned earlier. And then R just stands for related injuries. For the fracture patterns, the difference between an oblique fracture and a transverse fracture is that a transverse fracture is at an angle of less than 30 degrees. An oblique fracture would be at an angle of greater than 30 degrees. And you can actually measure that angle in the image viewer that you're using to look at these x-rays. Over time, you will get more of a feel for it, though, and you probably won't really have to measure the exact angle. Again, covering some of the things that aren't in either of the acronyms and that you probably won't find in the acronyms, you're going to want to look at alignment. Is there valgus or varus alignment? So valgus alignment is the distal segment is pointing away from your midline, and then varus alignment is your distal segment points towards the midline. The way I like to remember which one is which is that the L in valgus stands for lateral. And so what that means to me is the distal segment is going lateral, aka away from the midline. Another popular way that a lot of people like to remember it is by, I don't know if to call it a mnemonic, but it's Varus the pig. Like, where is the pig? And it's a picture or a meme of this farmer with the pig between his legs. And so, because of the pig being between his legs are in a varus alignment. It's a cute picture. You can look it up. Next on your to-do list for when reading an x-ray is that you're going to want to check if there's any angulation because of the fracture.
Is there any shortening? When it comes to translation slash displacement, this is an area where a lot of people will get messed up. When you're looking at two pieces of broken bone, if there's any displacement, you look at the distal fragment, and then the displacement refers to that distal fragment. So if the distal fragment is posterior to the more proximal fragment, you would say it's posteriorly displaced. The reason that can get confusing is because when you get, brought up on board rounds and you're having to answer in front of everyone, you're gonna think to yourself, oh wait, is it referring, do you refer to the proximal segment or do you refer to the distal segment, right? Because if it's the distal segment is posterior to the proximal segment, you could arguably say, well, the proximal segment is displaced anteriorly. And while that's not necessarily wrong because it's a little bit relative, the standard in orthopedics is to go off of the distal segment. And so if you just always remember that, write it down. Grave it in your brain, and that way you won't get tripped up there. You'll look like a superstar. Another issue that commonly comes up is angulation. This is typically an issue when you have a forearm fracture.
Angulation is like a tilt. The anatomical reference point is the long axis of the bone. And so when you have a forearm fracture, you can have volar angulation, dorsal angulation. You can also have medial or lateral angulation. And typically, the reason that this gets a little extra confusing is because if you have a fracture where the distal fragment is posterior compared to the proximal fragment, you would say that there's posterior angulation. You could also describe this using the apex of the fracture, which is where the fracture line is and it comes to a point. And so in this particular one, if you have a posterior angulation, then your apex would be anterior. Notably, when it comes to like forearm and hand, you typically say volar or dorsal, not anterior or posterior, just to be clearer. But so you could say apex volar or dorsal angulation, and it would mean the same thing. But again, it becomes a little confusing when you're trying to remember all the details and you're up on stage and you're like, okay, which fragment is it? Which one am I referring to? And it's just something that it takes a little bit of repetition to get comfortable with.
And then again, same thing. It's always about the distal segment. So just remember that it's all relative to the distal segment, and that'll keep you from being tripped up by this super high yield. If you take one thing away, remember it's the distal segment for a fracture to determine the angulation or the displacement.
So now that we've talked about fractures and how to visualize them, we can start talking about how fractures heal and the different fixation methods that we have available. So if you remember back to earlier in the podcast when we were talking about the two different types of bone formation, we had intramembranous ossification and endochondral ossification. When it comes to fracture healing, there are two main types. There's primary healing and then there's secondary healing. Primary healing is known as direct healing, and secondary healing is also known as indirect healing. Which type of bone healing your body ends up employing depends on how stable the fracture is. Primary healing, again also called direct healing, happens when you have absolute stability. So this is usually achieved through surgical fixation because the bone fragments are held so tightly together that there's minimal callus formation and the new bone forms directly across the fracture line, much like intramembranous ossification. Secondary healing occurs when there's relative stability, often achieved with casts or certain types of plates like bridge plates that allow for a bit of micromotion. In this situation, we would see callus formation, and it mimics the process of endochondral ossification. Right after the fracture, you would have hematoma formation, which would be followed by fibrocartilaginous callus formation, which would then turn into a bony callus formation, and eventually you would then see that bony remodeling. It's important to note that primary bone healing isn't natural. It only happens because of surgery and interfragmentary compression. The choice between these two healing pathways influences your treatment approach and what implants you're going to use. If your goal is anatomic reduction, meaning you want to perfectly align the bone fragments, then absolute stability and primary healing are your goals.
In order to achieve an anatomic reduction, you'll have to do what's called a direct reduction. And so a direct reduction is aligning the fracture under direct visualization. This is where the concept of open reduction and open reduction internal fixation comes from. You are exposing the fracture site. You are using your hands or instruments to manipulate the fracture to get as close to an anatomic reduction as possible.
This is often the case with fractures like your radius and ulna, where even slight misalignments can affect your movement, like your pronation and your supination. Then there are some situations where anatomic reduction isn't as critical, where you just need a functional reduction, meaning the relative spatial relationship of your proximal and distal articular surfaces are maintained.
If a functional reduction is your goal, then you can achieve this through indirect reduction, which is aligning the fracture without exposing the fracture site, aka a closed reduction. The manipulation occurs remotely from the fracture site, often outside of the skin, using traction, ligamentotaxis, or even percutaneously using clamps. A notable point about
indirect reduction is that it'll preserve the fracture site biology. And then remember, your goal is for an acceptable alignment, not necessarily an anatomic alignment.
One common pimping question you can get regarding functional reductions are, what are the three things that you need for a functional reduction? Those are length, alignment, and rotation.
Fractures of your long bones, like your humerus specifically, tend to handle well being managed non-operatively, which, as a side note, if you don't know what a Sarmiento brace is, you should really read about it and read some of the literature surrounding its early testing and how good the outcomes are. Basically, in short, it's a functional brace which compresses your soft tissues in order to hold the fracture in alignment. The overall structure of the brace allows patients to have complete range of motion of their shoulder and elbow while still maintaining the proper alignment of their humerus. Going back to primary and secondary healing, remembering that secondary healing has callus formation and primary healing does not is very high yield. And then knowing how the implants you're using relates to the type of healing that you're going to get is also very high yield. We'll go into the fixation types and the different implants more in the second part of the podcast, but you can get bogged down in the details a little bit with this topic if you start looking at what actually determines primary versus secondary in regards to strain and stability. So there's an equation for strain, which is elongation over original length. And basically, if your strain comes out to less than 2%, you have absolute stability. If your strain is between 2 and 10%, then you have relative stability. Then if your strain is over greater than 10%, you have high strain, and you probably will get like a non-union or malunion. But this probably isn't something that you will be directly asked about. Next, it's important that we talk about factors that might influence fracture healing. The most important factor for fracture healing is blood supply. And there are some areas of the body that have tenuous blood supplies that you are expected to know. You're going to want to know the relevant anatomy of these areas, as well as the blood supplies that make them up. First up is your proximal femoral head. Then is your proximal humerus. Then it's your scaphoid / your lunate. Then there's your talus and your navicular. And last, you have the second zone of your fifth metatarsal. Whenever you see fractures in these regions, you want to be extra alert for signs of AVN, malunion, or even non-union. Some other factors that might influence fracture healing are going to be patient-specific. And so these are things that you're definitely going to want to ask about when you're interviewing patients. Most attendings will want to know if your patient is a smoker, how often are they smoking. This also includes vaping, whether they are a diabetic, an IV drug user, and if they are obese. Regarding obesity, some attendings have specific BMI cutoffs for elective surgeries. Typically, above 40 BMI is what I've seen be used as a cutoff. These are all things that can not only influence your fracture healing, but it can also influence your incision healing and can increase your risk for infection. The reason we care so much about infection in orthopedics is because an infection can actually lead to osteolysis of your bone. And it's very hard to treat these infections without going in and retaking out all the implants that we've put in. So your attendings are going to be very inclined to know these things about your patient to try to minimize their risk for infection and minimize their risk of having a revision surgery. Importantly, some of the absolute indications for surgery can be found by you during your physical exam. If you find that a patient with a fracture has a vascular or neurological deficit, it might imply that the fractured bone is compressing on vessels or nerves,
and then increasing, therefore, the necessity for surgery.
While on the subject of physical exams, it's super high yields for you to know about compartment syndrome and the five P's, which are pain, pallor, paresthesia, paralysis, and pulselessness. A lot of attendings will want you to know that they don't necessarily come in order, and by the time that most patients will start to develop paresthesias or paralysis or pulselessness, it's actually already too late to save most of the muscle because it will have already necrosed from the increased intracompartmental pressure.
If and when you do take a patient with suspected compartment syndrome to the OR, you want to assess them for the four C's to assess their muscle viability. The four C's stand for color, consistency, contractility, and capacity to bleed. Notably, when it comes to compartment syndrome in pediatric patients, the mnemonic to remembering the symptoms is the three A's, not the five P's. And so the three A's are agitation, anxiety, and increased analgesic requirement. Because pediatric patients are not as good at communicating their symptoms as adult patients, it is important that you have an increased sensitivity to compartment syndrome in this population. There's a few different ways to actually measure the compartment pressure, but the actual threshold for the compartment pressure that an institution is going to use as their cutoff for taking someone to do a fasciotomy is a little institution specific. But it's important to note that the actual diagnosis of compartment syndrome is a clinical diagnosis, and so you do not need to take measurements to diagnose someone with compartment syndrome. It is based off the physical exam findings and the patient history. You would only proceed to take intracompartmental pressure measurements if there were doubts regarding your physical exam findings and you wanted additional diagnostic studies to confirm the diagnoses. But it is not necessary to take these measurements before actually proceeding to the fasciotomy if the physical exam findings are very clear cut.
Some studies have shown that delta 30, so your intracompartmental pressure is within 30 millimeters of mercury from your diastolic blood pressure, that should be considered compartment syndrome. Other studies advocate for it simply being a pressure over 30 millimeters of mercury within the compartment be the threshold for compartment syndrome. The reason that there's debate is because you want a perfect specificity and sensitivity to diagnose people with compartment syndrome so that you're not getting any false positives, because a fasciotomy is not a benign procedure. And so you don't want to be fasciotomizing people for no reason. So it's definitely important to talk to your residents and see what their threshold is. Either way, though, if there is a patient on the floor who is suspected of having compartment syndrome, you as the medical student are most likely not going to be the one taking those intracompartmental pressures. That's the job of a resident. And at most institutions, it's basically considered like an operative procedure to take those pressures. So if you see any patients who are having unrelenting pain and it's progressively getting worse and it's worse on passive stretch, that should really raise your suspicion of compartment syndrome, and it's something you should definitely bring up to your residents. Notably, fractures account for approximately 69% of compartment syndrome cases. 36% of those are from tibia fractures, while 10% are from distal radius fractures. The second most common cause overall is from crush injuries. And even among fractures, there are some specific injuries which have an increased risk of compartment syndrome. And you're definitely going to want to know those. Those are super high yield. Commonly, a supracondylar humerus fracture has an increased risk of compartment syndrome in kids. And in adults, any tibia fracture like a pilon, a tibial plateau, or even a posterior knee dislocation is going to see some increased risk for compartment syndrome. So you'll definitely want to keep an eye out for them also. But it's important to note that it can happen with any fracture, any injury, even open fractures. It's super high yield to know that compartment syndrome can happen even if you have an open fracture. Some attendings, if they're pimping you about this, they might want to trick you into thinking that, oh, it's open, so the pressure can kind of leak out through where the open wound is. And that's not necessarily the case. For starters, the bone could be blocking the exit, so the pressure is not escaping. Secondly, there's different compartments in your limbs. And so while the pressure in one compartment might be relieved, unless you're relieving the pressure in all the compartments, then you're not addressing the issue. And that's actually something important to note about doing a fasciotomy, is that you want to make sure that you release all of the compartments. In the lower extremity specifically, there's a lot of cases of surgeons who doing a fasciotomy will miss the deep posterior compartment. And so that's also something high yield that you want to keep in the back of your mind. You should have a general idea of where the fasciotomy incision lines would go. And for in general, for any surgery that you're scrubbing in on, you're going to want to know the different compartments of the limb that you're operating on. On that note, I think it's probably time to cover some of the materials out there that you can use to prep for cases and for your away rotations. There's quite a few, and it depends a lot on your learning style. If you like to read, if you like to watch videos, if you like to do Anki. So obviously this is going to be a little bit biased in terms of what I like, what I found useful, but I think most of these resources, at the very least, you should consider checking out. For starters, there is a website called OrthoAccess. And OrthoAccess is a program out of the University of Chicago. Their orthopedic residency program director created this program in collaboration with many other programs in order to help prepare students for their away rotations. So this resource is specifically made for students about to start their orthopedic away rotations. There are two ways to use this resource. It is completely free. You can watch the pre-recorded lectures on their website from previous years. They will have Anki decks for you that you can download. Highly recommend downloading them and using them. They're very good. When you're finished with the lecture and the Anki deck, they will typically have a case discussion, which is also pre-recorded, but you can go to live via Zoom. I highly recommend going to the case discussions if you have the time. The only qualm I have with them is that it's actually very hard to do if you are a student who's about to actually start their away rotations. Because while they start very early, around, I want to say, April, May, they go on for very long, well into when you would have started your away rotations.
and they are at times, they're always at the same time every week. And depending on what time zone you are in, that time is either too early or way too late. And so once you're actually on your way rotations, at least for, in my situation, I found that I never went to the case discussions anymore. I only ever went to them before I started doing my way rotations. The case discussions, the reason you want to go to them live if you can, is because after the case discussion, they will do breakout rooms with some of the faculty that they had, and they will announce usually a week before what faculty they're going to have on that week. And so if it's faculty at an institution that you're interested in, it's a chance to say hello, get to know them a little bit, ask them about their program. They're probably not going to remember you, but if you're doing an away rotation and it's at somewhere that one of these attendings is at, it doesn't hurt to say, hey, I like your program. I'm coming to rotate there. And then actually, you know, kind of reminding them of that when you actually get there, it doesn't hurt. Overall, though, OrthoAccess, I think it's a great resource and you guys should definitely use it. You don't actually have to be about to go on your away rotations. If you are a third year or second year, or even I've seen first years on the calls who is interested in orthopedics, they are happy to have you there. There's really no barrier or anything to underclassmen doing it. It's just might be a little bit more advanced than what your knowledge base is ready for. But if you're using the online materials to prep ahead of time, then that really should not be an issue.
Another free online resource you can use is OrthoBullets. OrthoBullets is kind of like a Wikipedia page for orthopedics. In the same way that you wouldn't necessarily tell your high school teacher or your college professor that you used Wikipedia to figure out your answer, you don't necessarily want to tell your attending that the source for your answer is OrthoBullets, but it nonetheless is a great place for you to get a big picture idea of what you're studying. And they do have links to some primary literature, which you can then dive deeper into. It's great, especially if you are just needing a quick review before a surgery that you've seen before, or even if it's your first time trying to prep for a case, it's a great place to start. I probably looked at OrthoBullets at least once a day during my away rotations. Obviously, though, you want to limit how much you're on your phone during away rotations, because you don't want it to look like you're texting.
Going back to the Anki cards that OrthoAccess provides you, there is another ortho deck circulating the realm of Reddit that you could want to download if you are interested in orthopedics, and it's called the Marty McFlyin deck, and that's MCFLYIN, I believe. And if you literally type in Marty McFlyin ortho Anki Reddit, it should come up. It's a great deck. I have it. I used it a lot during medical school to prepare for any shadowing I was doing. And I definitely used it during my away rotations on top of the OrthoAccess cards.
The great thing about the Marty McFlyin deck is that it actually pulls from a lot of the resources that people are going to recommend to you for prepping for away rotations. So it actually has images from Netter's Orthopedic Anatomy. It has a lot of cards that are based off of the questions that are in that little book called Pocket Pimped, which is also a great resource. And so therefore, it's a great resource because not only is it free, I feel like it's easier to study from, and you're probably going to retain it longer if you use it through the Anki deck.
The issue with the Marty McFlyin deck is just that it's a lot. It's a lot of good information. It is basically resident level. I have seen actual second and third year residents using this deck to learn for the first time what they're learning on the service that they're on. So I highly recommend it, but it's definitely not something that you're going to want to take on last minute. When you go to do your away rotations, most places will typically have you put down your top 1 to 3 subspecialties and then let you know a week before what subspecialty you're actually going to be on. If you're not doing anything the week before, then maybe you can make that work. But if you're on a different away rotation and you're going to be jumping right into the next one, you might want to consider picking the same 3 subspecialties and really focusing down on those so that you know it well. Other materials that you can use to prep: Netter's Concise Orthopedic Anatomy, and I emphasize orthopedic because there's a lot of versions of Netter's out there. You want the orthopedic version. This is good if you are someone who likes to read. There are PDF versions online that you can find for free. There are also like physical hard copies that you can buy online, and they are small. They'll fit in your white coat pocket if that's something that you want to buy. The nice thing about this specific book is that because it's focused on orthopedics, one of the sections in each chapter is focused on the typical surgical approaches that you would use for that extremity. It'll tell you why you would use this approach, what are some of the at-risk structures when using that approach, and it'll also tell you the internervous planes. It'll tell you any relevant anatomy. It'll also even give you a view of what it should kind of look like when you're in the operating room, what muscles are going to be where and retracted, how, and then it'll kind of show you the layers a little bit. And so it's very nice in that sense. There's a lot of other textbooks out there that you can use, like Rockwood and Green's Fracture Textbook in Adults, or Handbook of Fractures is also very common. Campbell's Operative Orthopedics is also very common. These are a bit more advanced in terms of the material you will be covering. And it's very hard to retain, in my opinion, that information if you're just reading out of a textbook. But if you're wanting to go to an institution where there is a lot of the primary authors for a specific book, then you should definitely give it a read, because it'll allow you to kind of get into their mindset a little bit and know what they might be looking for when they ask you those read my mind questions. So some specific examples of this would be like Rockwood and Green's Fractures in Adults. A lot of the authors are at Boston Medical Center. Campbell's Operative Orthopedics, a lot of their authors are at the Campbell Clinic in Tennessee. Another important resource that you can use that you already have access to is that anatomy app that you got on your iPads. You can actually get it on your phone also. It's a little harder to use, but it is super great for a quick last minute review of some of the anatomy that you might be operating on that day, to see it in a three-dimensional structure, to see it beyond the borders of kind of what's in the textbook. And then also just, it allows you to get a little bit more in detail than some of the textbooks might have in some of the images, just so that you can kind of connect the bigger picture and see how it all ties in together. So these are the resources that if I were you, I would primarily focus on using. There are other resources that if you have the extra time might be beneficial as like a second pass. And those resources would include things like ViewMedi, which is a free website. If you make an account, you can watch actual surgeons walk through the steps of a procedure. And so that's helpful before you go in the actual day of a surgery that you're seeing for the first time, so that you already know some of the steps and kind of what you're looking for and what's going on. If you are going to be on a joints rotation, highly recommend the hip and knee book.
despite the confusing name, it is actually a website. And it's just hipandkneebook.com. This resource will cover a lot of the basics for total knees and total hips. And if you can manage to read all of it, or even most of it, it'll teach you a lot of the basic principles behind these surgeries and the implants and how they work. And it's, I hesitate to say everything you would need to know for a joints rotation, but it will definitely be most of what you will need. A lot of the information though in this website probably isn't expected for you to know, but it is definitely a way for you to hopefully impress the attending that you're with, to show them that you've read and that you understand some of the reasoning behind the decision-making that's taking place and not just knowing the steps and the anatomy. For anatomy, besides the application that we get through the school on our iPads and phones, UCSF has a ortho anatomy core, which we'll go over a lot of the surgical approaches and, again, the neurovascular structures that you're going to encounter on a orthopedic rotation. And so it's also a great resource to use if you have the time or if you don't want to buy netters. And then I think the only other resource I'll mention is the Orthopedic Trauma Association, the OTA, has these core curriculum lectures. They're PowerPoints on their website. And if you Google OTA core curriculum lectures, you'll find them. And they basically cover any injury you can think of. It'll have some of the most recent literature on different treatment methods, their outcomes. It is a wonderful resource to be up to date for your trauma rotation. In addition to the OTA slides, AO Trauma is also a great resource for any cases that you might be encountering on your trauma rotation. This is a website that was founded by the AO Foundation, which is a group primarily of orthopedic trauma surgeons based out of Switzerland. On the website, you'll find step-by-step instructions for the surgery, and you'll also see some great images that they themselves create in-house and can help you to better understand what's going on during a step of the procedure or how a certain implant works. One other nice thing about the AO website is that it can actually tell you what imaging you are supposed to get based on the type of injury that you are looking at. So if you encounter a pelvis injury, it would tell you that you should be getting an AP view, an inlet view, and an outlet view of your pelvis, as well as possibly Judae views. And if you don't know what those are, the nice thing about the AO website is that there's also details about what these different views are, what you're looking for in them, how they take the images of the patient, like actually take the images with the x-ray, so that you can get a better understanding of what's actually going on.
All that being said, guys, I think we're out of time for this first episode. At the end of the day, for your away rotations, the most important thing is to always come in with a positive attitude. Be willing to go that extra mile. Come in early, stay late. You know, no one's going to be upset if you get a question wrong the first time, but make sure you get it if you're asked the question again a second time. And so, while it's tempting to want to absorb all this information and study as much as you can before these rotations, just remember that it's not necessarily the most important thing. It's a lot more important to show that you have a positive attitude and that you're someone who these people are going to want to work with for 5 years. And with that being said, I'll catch you guys on the next episode.